sometimes we can be better Christians by actually listening to the objections of those who think our faith is not based on reality. Sometimes that's a good way for us to recognize some of our own doubts. And there's nothing like recognizing your doubts to motivate you to understand why they're there and what to do about it. So I guess maybe I'd like to encourage everybody who's a Christian to get outside of a comfortable circle of people who think just like you and see whether that expands your own ability to dig deeper into the faith and what it means.
That was Francis Collins, the founder of BioLogos. Welcome to Language of God. I'm Jim Stump, and I'm back with BioLogos President Deb Harsma for this second part of our interview with Francis Collins.
I'm happy to be here.
In case you missed part one, it was the very first episode of our new podcast where we talked to Francis about his own scientific work and his conversion story. Deb, what are we going to hear this time?
In this episode, Francis talks about his book, The Language of God, and some stories about the founding of BioLogos.
Those may be very interesting to people who have been tracking the organization for these last 10 years.
Yeah, I think so. And then we get to some neat stories from Francis Collins about junk DNA, his reactions to intelligent design. He talks about his relationship with atheist Christopher Hitchens. That's such a neat story. Mm-hmm. He even talks about doubt and the role of science, the limits of science. So lots to listen to.
Exciting stuff. Well, let's get to the...
Hey, can I say it this time?
Yes, boss.
Let's get to the conversation.
Let's talk about BioLogos. We are coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the launching of the BioLogos website. And the way we tell the story, at least the Cliff's Notes version of the story, you had finished the Human Genome Project and needed something else to do with your time, so you wrote a book, which ultimately led to the founding of BioLogos.
Well, there are a few other steps involved.
I suspect it's slightly more complex than that, but walk us through some of that.
Sure. I had become a Christian while I was still in medical training. By the time I got to be a faculty member, I was not shy about talking about my faith, but I didn't seek out opportunities to grab the podium. But medical students at Michigan were interested in hearing that story and began to ask me to speak sort of for optional lunch sessions. And I found that to be pretty interesting. They were all curious and sort of glad that you could have this conversation and it wasn't scary. And then a very significant moment, I got invited to speak at Harvard, of all places, in the Memorial Church at an annual series called the Nobel Lectures, not Nobel, Nobel Lectures, which is an annual event where, due to some bequest, somebody is supposed to come and talk for three consecutive nights in the middle of February about some topic that says that faith is actually relevant to modern life. And I agreed to do this with some trepidation, and I had to work pretty hard on putting together the thoughts that I wanted to share over three nights. And I was astounded that every one of those nights, the attendance, 600 or 700 undergraduates, most of whom I would guess were not believers, some there curious, some there to try to shoot down the arguments, but all of them hungry to have this conversation. And I would meet with them during the day and they would say, why aren't we hearing about this in the rest of our curriculum? We're at Harvard and this is the one thing we don't talk about? What?
What year was this?
This was 2003. I came away from that feeling like, wow, maybe God is calling me to do more of this, stimulating the conversation. I don't have all the answers, but at least I can put forward an opportunity for people to talk about something profound. At which point I began to think about whether writing a book might be a way to get that started. I got approached by an editor at Simon & Schuster who thought from what he'd heard that this might be something they'd be very interested in. And Bruce Nichols became a dear friend, and he argued with me over almost 2 years about writing this book, and I argued that I didn't have time, and finally decided, okay, got to give it a try. And that was challenging because I was still running the National Human Genome Research Institute. The genome project was done, but we had all of these other things we were doing to try to understand what the genome was teaching us. So that was more than a full-time job. And I wrote a lot of the language of God on weekends and at nights sitting in my basement. So over the course of a year, it came together. Still at this point, I thought this was a book that maybe a few thousand people might want to read. And it almost felt like I need to get this out of my system. I wasn't sure how much of an audience it would have. It surprised me within the first week or two after it came out. And all of a sudden, oh my gosh, it's on the New York Times bestseller list, which never in my dreams did I imagine it would have that kind of reach. And clearly, again, maybe it's what I learned at Harvard. There's a hunger for having this conversation and not having it where people are throwing mud at each other and not having it where the only perspective you hear is coming from one of the extremes of the spectrum, but actually from somebody who's arguing for harmony instead of discord, which was how I felt the conversation ought to go.
And it has reached so many people. We still hear people. I just met somebody last month, and he walks into a BioLogos event and says, oh, you know, this is my first time at a BioLogos event, but I recently picked up a copy of The Language of God. He said he'd been an atheist for 20 years.
No.
He was a physician, practicing physician, and had just seen no way to make it work. He said he took home the book and showed it to his wife and said, this is what I'm looking for. Somebody's putting it all together. And he was so excited about his faith and about having science be a part of that. So it's amazing how many people it's continuing to impact one by one. And through visibility online, it's amazing.
More than I could have imagined. So obviously this was God's plan, not mine. Mm-hmm. I do encounter just this week at a science meeting with 9,000 people there, mostly geneticists. There must have been at least a dozen people who came up and said, you know, I was not quite sure what to think about faith, thought there might be something there, and I read your book and it really helped me. That's just amazing to keep hearing that. And the book keeps finding its way into college courses and
church. Do you know how many copies have been sold?
I haven't kept track. It's probably about 500,000.
Wow.
About. So the book comes out and I think, oh, wow, people are actually interested in this. And then I think, oh, wow, look at my email inbox. People were not only interested, they had follow-up questions like, well, you said this, but you didn't say that. And how do you explain this particular point of view? And had you thought about? And within a few weeks, I had more than 1,000 of those. Oh. And maybe for the first day or two, I tried to answer. And I thought, I can't do this. It was pretty clear, though, that there was some repetitive aspect to this. There were certain questions that came up over and over again. I thought, well, maybe I could try to at least come up with some kind of short list of the frequently asked questions and try to put together some kind of response to that. And I'd have something to send to people. But again, how am I going to do that? I'm not a theologian. I'm certainly not a philosopher. I'm not that well read in a lot of the broad areas that people are asking about. I need help. So this was the moment where the idea of having some assistance came up. And this is when I learned about the Trinity Forum Academy. And that's how I came to meet Simon Stevens and David Scudder and Monica Slinkard. And so I got the three of them signed up to try to help with this idea of frequently asked questions. And could we at least try to assemble the incoming emails in some kind of rational fashion? But this was also the point where I realized this is not something that's going to be like one and done. This is an ongoing discussion. And it's a good discussion. And a lot of these questions are really thoughtful. And there are people out there that want to take part in this and not just sort of have a quick soundbite. They want to have an ongoing, serious discussion. So how to do that? That's where the idea of having some kind of organization had to come to pass. And the idea, therefore, of setting up a nonprofit that would be a home for this kind of discussion and ultimately a meeting place, at least on the internet, also seemed like the right idea. Well, this then came back to what really to call this position that the language of God was putting forward, that science and faith are in fact speaking harmoniously to each other. And obviously the place where I had the most to say about that was in life science, and the place where everybody was hung up was evolution. The terminology that had been traditionally used for this perspective that God is the author of evolution, and so evolution is God's means of carrying out creation, was called theistic evolution. I never liked the term. It put evolution as the noun and theistic as the adjective, suggesting that one was dominating the other. And it turned a lot of people off. And so it seemed necessary to come up with an alternative. And so in the book, after thinking about that for a while, if you have to make up a new word, well, go to the Greek. It's always a good place to start. My mother taught me, remember at home, one of the things she taught me was how you figure out when you look at a word where it came from. So you show me a word, I can tell you if that came from Greek or Latin or Old French. And Greek was always the best. So let's go to that. So what are we talking about? We're talking about life. Well, that's bios. But life as God's creation. Oh, the logos, the word. In the beginning was the word. Bios through logos. Well, okay, let's just make that shorter. And hence the new neologism got born of biologos. And hopefully that's been a good choice. Deb, you can tell me whether that has stood the test of time over these 10 years.
It has. And I think a lot of people are, were also trained by their mothers or teachers to take a word apart, and they get right away, oh, bios for life, logos, especially the theologians. They all go for, they all say logos right away because yes, apparently that's the pronunciation
that they prefer.
That they learn. So people take that apart right away. And I love how you say it's not just life and word, it's life through the word. It's yeah, a whole phrase it's referring to. I really like that. And for those who know the Bible, it just it immediately reminds you of that first, that opening prologue of the Gospel of John. Yes. The beginning was the Word, and through him all things were made. It's a beautiful word, and it draws people in. It sounds a little bit scientific, a little bit religious, and it makes them want to know more. So it's a perfect word for us.
Okay, so you've got this team of people putting together some questions that go onto a website eventually. That didn't happen right away, but.
And with this nonprofit in place, we actually able to get some support from the Templeton Foundation, which made it possible for this to have a very modest budget so that we could begin to have some staffing. And Simon, after getting his degree at Columbia, agreed to come on as the first executive director full-time. He would come and meet with me around my dining room table once a week for pretty much a whole day, riding his motorcycle up, and we would talk science, faith, and motorcycles.
That sounds like a book title. Science, faith, and motorcycles.
And he is incredibly organized and very thoughtful. And it began to take shape. But it was time to get this launched in a more official way, and especially to get the website up there, because we could see there's such a hunger for that as a meeting place for people who had a real desire to engage in a civil discourse about how the scientific and spiritual worldviews could not just get along, but could enrich each other, which is where we thought this could go. And to my surprise, that same month of April 2009 was when I got the phone call saying, we want you to agree to be nominated by President Obama to be the director of the National Institutes of Health. Not just the genome part, the whole thing, to oversee the work of 27 institutes and centers that cover everything from basic science to clinical trials. And the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world. Gulp. Something I never dreamed of, certainly never would have planned for. And yet, pretty hard to say, well, no, I'm busy. It doesn't suit me. Maybe this is what God was calling me to do. And maybe that's what I was restless to discover. At the time of the launch, I knew that offer had been extended, but I was not at liberty to tell anybody. Mm. I remember that launch evening in a hotel room in DC as a very special gathering of people. It really felt like a moment. BioLogos is really now out there as a place where something exciting is going to happen. And not a secret anymore. And yet at the same time, I have this uneasy feeling about what's that going to mean for me if I'm about to be plunged into this other new role. The new role finally did get announced in July. And I think it was about then that I was called to the White House. Another memory that I can see in my mind's eye of sitting at a table with, I think there were at least six lawyers. There might have been more talking about what are the restrictions on you if you're a presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed leader of some government institution. And I went into that expecting that they would have no problem with my continuing to play a leadership role with BioLogos because it seemed disconnected from my official duties. And I was told quite bluntly that was not the case, that you shall have no other involvement with any organization, regardless of its mission or its goals. If you can't see yourself stepping away from BioLogos, then you'll have to step away from being NIH director. It was just that clear.
Oh, man. It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, I just didn't see that coming. The gloomiest part of saying yes to becoming NIH director was having to step away from this own sort of newborn baby called BioLogos. And now looking back on this, 10 years... BioLogos has just flourished. Every day when I get one of those messages from somebody who tells me their own story about how they were wrestling with these issues, and maybe they ran into the language of God or maybe they didn't, but they found out about BioLogos and they saw that I was the founder, and they're just so excited now to be able to learn from that. That happens all the time. What the way in which this has been a magnet to bring together an incredible group of scholars, some of them theologians, some of them scientists, some of them both, some of them just people who care deeply about this issue. It's remarkable. That kind of assemblage hadn't happened before, bringing together all of these voices that had a lot in common, but maybe didn't really have a home they could come to together and make the whole greater than the sum of the parts. And that seems to be what's happening.
Yeah. And we hear all the time from people who feel really isolated, who have discovered us, and they're like, oh, there are other people who love Jesus Christ and want to hold to the best science. And I knew there must have been some way to put this together. I thought maybe there was, or I'd never heard of a way there was. And then now they've found a home.
Yeah, I love those. I love also the ones who said, you know, I always thought that this debate between Creator God and evolution could be solved so readily by just saying, well, this was part of God's plan. And now here's a group that actually is saying that too, and they all have that same view. And I didn't realize how I had this vision all along, and now it's being endorsed and supported by a very thoughtful, credible base of rational people. Hooray.
Yeah, exactly.
It seems to me that one of the successes of BioLogos in those early years was the meetings that took place in private, not big public meetings, but gatherings to which fairly prominent people were invited to hear this story, first behind closed doors.
Yeah, because people like were a little uneasy.
Like it or not, culturally, this position, especially in those days, brought some risks with it.
It did.
What do you remember from those early meetings and the conversations and the kind of impact that those had?
Well, those meetings were closed door because I think a lot of the people we invited would not have wanted it to be publicly described that they were involved in a conversation that says maybe evolution is not of the devil. It's actually scientifically incredibly strongly supported, and you could see how this was God's plan all along. Those meetings, which would go on for 2.5 days and involved both presentations and discussions and worship together, were memorable. One of those sort of life experiences that you will never forget, especially the worshiping together, that we didn't, weren't just there to have an intellectual argument. I go to plenty of those meetings. We were also there to pray and to sing. Oh, the singing was always amazing in those gatherings.
Was that your idea at the beginning to include that?
Deb, you came to those first as an attendee with no formal connection to BioLogos.
That's right.
What was your impression of those meetings?
Yeah. A chance for me as a scientist to hear the kinds of concerns that these faith leaders had and the risks that they sometimes felt. And it was, just a wonderful time. And I too think the worship was key. That really, it helped us all feel like deep in our souls vibrating in your bones that we are all Christians together. We are all worshiping the same God.
Yeah.
And there was one of those where somebody wrote on their evaluation form afterwards, it's like, okay, I'm not sure I agree with it, but I learned that those people at BioLogos, they're not believing it just because there's some liberal group. That's not why they're accepting evolution, but they're just really smart scientists who are Christ followers, and they just think that this is really important. And so I want to have a conversation with them. And it was just a beautiful comment. And that's what we were hoping for. And what it did for BioLogos is it built trust. And through those meetings, we learned how important trust building was.
And a community that got to know each other by who somebody is really like when they're in a setting of that sort, as opposed to what they wrote in an article 5 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. With no audience to play to, just what they were thinking. They had all these rules that you couldn't quote anybody outside of this meeting. What was said in the room was for in the room, so people could just think out loud. And it built trust and community. And it's only after you have that that people are willing to dig into the arguments. They need that first. We need it.
We've, as an organization, had several more of those kind of encounters. And I think you, Francis, have been part of those with other individuals from organizations that might not accept everything that we do that with regard to the science. Do you remember other of those conversations and maybe how those have changed over time or how BioLogos has been perceived within the community of Christian organizations that's been involved in science, perhaps using science as a different kind of tool or apologetic in ways that we haven't thought were entirely fruitful, but those kind of personal interactions that have been maintained even in the midst of disagreements?
BioLogos has always stood up for approaching differences of opinion with respect and with love, and refusing to sink to disparaging comments about other people's intentions or about whether they're really serious Christians or serious scientists if they don't agree with us. BioLogos has never done that, will never do that. Respect that there are lots of sincere people trying to sort these issues out. The relationship we've had now for a long time with Reasons to Believe with Hugh Ross's group is a good example of that. They, of course, as old Earth creationists, we have great similarities in terms of dating of the age of the universe and of the Earth, but still differ in terms of human origins in substantive ways. And we've engaged in many debates about that, again, trying to pull across the best interpretations of Scripture and the most current science to see where things stand. I think we have to agree to disagree and have done so, but in a very respectful way. that says a lot, because that has not been the tradition in the past in terms of differing views about how to approach science and faith. And I think we remain totally open to continuing that kind of approach, even to those who have a very different perspective. It's harder, of course, for the young Earth creationist perspective and BioLogos to find common ground, but always willing to try to seek out that kind of opportunity with folks who hold that view. And always willing to engage with agnostics and atheists who would like to have a conversation about whether any of this makes sense to them or not. And I hope that will enlarge as time goes on, that BioLogos has developed this stance of credibility and integrity and respect for all perspectives. And hopefully that draws people to come and learn what we have to offer without feeling like they're going to get criticized or in some way considered lesser than if they don't see exactly the same answers that we do. And let's be clear, when you go to BioLogos' website and you come across one of these questions, it's really profound, you will rarely see BioLogos say, oh, well, here's the answer. You will see BioLogos say, deeply thoughtful people down through time and right up to the present time with the best science have considered several options of how this might be worked out. Who were Adam and Eve? I take that as a good example. We are basically laying out for you what some of those possible answers might be without necessarily saying, we know for sure that one of them is right and the others are wrong. Look at the evidence yourself and then let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm. We love hosting the conversation and nurturing the conversation by providing, here's options for people to talk about. Here's the background information you need. Here's some of the pros and cons. Have you ever thought of this? Have you ever thought of that?
Yeah.
And it helps everybody slow down and have a better conversation.
Right. Instead of moving quickly to their respective corners.
Yes. And starting to throw the rhetorical barbs at each other.
Yeah.
Speaking of rhetorical barbs, one of the arguments presented in Language of God for evolution, for common ancestry in particular, is the genetic evidence that has seemed so compelling to so many people over the last couple of decades. At the time of the writing of the book, you used the phrase junk DNA as this major portion of the genome that doesn't seem to be coding for proteins and thus acquires mutations more easily, and these are passed on and able to be compared. Since then, perhaps that term junk DNA has been found to be perhaps not as appropriate, and one of the other leading origins organizations in the country often likes to quote you as saying, this was a big mistake for us to ever use this word junk DNA, and they have leveraged that into using your words to even cast suspicion on the genetic argument for common ancestry. I wonder if you might care to set the record straight on any of that.
Sure. I've always thought, and I hope I said in the book, I have to go back and read exactly how I phrased it, that the use of junk to describe DNA is probably not the greatest way to describe this amazing instruction book, even little parts of it that we haven't learned much about the function. Somebody once said, it's okay to call it junk. It's the kind of stuff you keep in your attic in case you might use it someday. But let's not call it garbage. It's not garbage. So, okay. It is true. The more that we learn about the genome, and I'm not sure I'm surprised by this, the more we understand that the parts that don't code for protein, which is 98%, actually have really critical functions. They had to in order to have the instructions there to turn genes on or off in the right tissue at the right time. This regulatory part of the genome is incredibly important. My own lab works intensively on that right now, trying to understand how those regulatory changes and variations between people play a role in whether you get diabetes or not. And we've learned a lot about that. So it's clear, a lot of the genome may not code for protein, but it's really functionally important. It is also still true that almost half of the genome is made up of repetitive elements that are sort of selfish bits of propagating DNA that have landed in lots of places and have been carried along, some of which turn out to have really interesting functions, because there's no reason they couldn't also do so. I think it's unlikely that every one of those will turn out to be critical for the function of the genome. In fact, I think it's probably almost certainly not going to be the case that every one has a function. So there's going to be bits and pieces of the human genome that are sort of dispensable. Maybe we shouldn't call it junk, however, because that seems to have gotten everybody a little riled up about this. I do find it sort of ironic that this particular argument is being used to say that other aspects of what we've learned about human relatedness to other species, which is very compelling, is somehow no longer to be trusted because that guy who led the Human Genome Project misled us on this, as if I haven't been following the data lately. Anybody who sort of sees that, I hope they'll look a little more deeply and see this is really an argument that has not much behind it. This is one of those debates about the use of a particular noun, namely junk, that probably wasn't well chosen. So setting that aside, is there anything that what we've learned about the function of the genome that decreases our confidence that we humans are related to other species? No. Actually, everything we learn day after day, year after year, adds to that absolutely compelling evidence. I think anybody who objectively looks at this would say the evidence that we humans are part of this evolutionary tree is at least as compelling as the evidence that gravity really operates on objects that have mass. You may call it a theory because we call it the theory of gravity, but the evidence is overwhelming.
Right, so thinking back to your faith story, Christian faith isn't just about the arguments and the intellectual side, and it's having that hard relationship with God, and then it's following God. And that's something I've admired in your faith, that you live it out. And a story that I just love is how you worked with Christopher Hitchens. Mm. Could you tell us a little bit about that was like?
Yeah, Hitch became a dear friend, despite our obvious differences in terms of matters of faith, he being the author of the book, God is Not Great, and a variety of other incredibly entertaining and well-articulated arguments about atheism being the only real appropriate choice for a thinking person. I initially got to know him as a debating partner, and it's not easy being a debating partner of Christopher Hitchens because he had such skill in that space. And he could also be really obnoxious in that space, especially after a few scotches, which it was often the case when he was debating. But you had to admire the guy's intellect, and you had to admire how he'd done his homework. I wish a lot of Christians knew the Bible as well as Christopher Hitchens did, because he could throw that back at you so quick, just when you thought you were making a point. So, yeah, first we were kind of intellectual sparring partners, and then he got sick. And he reached out to me saying, I don't know what to do. And it was clear he was very sick. At the time he was first diagnosed, he already had cancer that had spread beyond its original starting place, and for which the outlook was going to be really grim. And I volunteered to try to help get him knowledge about what kind of experimental protocols might be available. He had his genome sequenced. He had the DNA sequence of his cancer determined to complete detail, and it suggested a drug that otherwise would never have been used for his cancer, which I think did enable him to survive a bit longer. And through all of that, we spent time together in his apartment in D.C. or occasionally in an emergency room. And it would start off as a conversation about medicine, but then it would migrate into questions about faith or Thomas Jefferson or whatever it was that was on his mind. And when he wasn't scoring points in front of an undergraduate audience, he could be a really nice guy. So he became somebody I was friends with. Did I have any impact on him? I can't say that I did. I guess some have tried to claim that towards the end, maybe he rethought his position. I think he thought about it all along. I don't think that he made a big transition into the category of believers. He respected believers when he wasn't debating them.
Okay.
And I think he made it very clear he respected my faith, even though he disagreed with it. But shouldn't we be doing that sort of thing? Trying to spend time with people who don't agree with us. Iron sharpens iron. Sometimes we can be better Christians by actually listening to the objections of those who think our faith is not based on reality. Sometimes that's a good way for us to recognize some of our own doubts. And there's nothing like recognizing your doubts to motivate you to understand why they're there and what to do about it. So I guess maybe I'd like to encourage everybody who's a Christian to get outside of a comfortable circle of people who think just like you and see whether that expands your own ability to dig deeper into the faith and what it means.
Mm-hmm. How have other people in the scientific community that you run in responded to your very public profession of faith?
Most of them have been pretty respectful. Occasionally, I've encountered people who have suggested this is really not an appropriate thing. It might be okay for you to believe those things, but do you have to talk about it? When I was first nominated to be director of NIH, there were some fairly outspoken voices who said that was really inappropriate, and that would be putting somebody in charge of biomedical research in the U.S. who might not be depending on the best science, but actually leaning in certain directions because of religious faith. Sam Harris was particularly strong in that viewpoint. I don't think too many people now, 9.5 years later, would say that that has turned out to be a risk. I think as my job requires, I'm a scientist first and foremost. When I'm trying to make a decision about where we're going with investing resources in diabetes research or cancer or autism, I try to figure out what's the public health need, what's the scientific opportunity, who else is able to do this, and we make that decision. When it comes to ethical issues, my foundation for ethics is pretty much the Judeo-Christian set of principles which all bioethicists ascribe to, even the ones who are atheists. So it's remarkable when it comes to ethical issues how often we come down in the same place.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I talk with scientists in the scientific community, I get just a lot of apathy of not being interested in the bigger questions at all, of saying, well, it's fine if you want to be religious, but I don't see any reason for needing that on top of anything else. Do you have any feel for how do you begin those conversations with people?
Well, I recognized myself when I was 22 or 23.
So. And there it was, a patient asking you a question.
Yeah.
So,
And what I learned from that is it's good to ask the question and not simply assume that that person doesn't want to think about it, doesn't want to talk about it. I understand this completely. We are scientists. We are attached to the idea that the way to learn about how the world works, how nature is put together, is the scientific method, and that that ought to be enough for getting answers to anything. Mm-hmm. And it's a little threatening to say there are really important questions that science can't help you with. And that starts to sound a little scary, and maybe like you're slipping into a space that a scientist should not slip into. Mm-hmm. I do think it's useful in those kinds of conversations to point out that there really are some profound questions that science doesn't answer. Is there a God? Does that God care about you and me? Or even stepping further back to the most profound of all the philosophical questions, why is there something instead of nothing? I think even the most hard-bitten materialist scientist will admit that science isn't going to get you a good answer on that one. Mm-hmm. A few have tried, but that at least opens up the possibility that there's another sphere of intellectual discussion that would be kind of important to pursue that is not a science experiment. Mm-hmm. And I think you can also say, well, aren't those the most important questions? Mm-hmm. If you think about the whole broad swath of human experience, do you want to rule those out? Like, no, they're not part of my portfolio of issues just because you can't answer them scientifically. Does that feel right?
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can poke at that just a little bit.
Go ahead, poke.
In the book especially, you describe your journey of coming to faith in very scientific sounding terms. You are a scientist, so yeah. I think we can give you a pass on sounding like a scientist. There's something wrong with that. You should sound like a scientist. But here, when you just said, this isn't a scientific question, is there a God? But in many ways, your exploration of that was certainly informed by you as a scientist of trying to find the data, trying to find the reasons. Mm-hmm. You say when the patient asked you that question, what do you believe? You thought, I need to explore this question. Mm-hmm. I need to ask this. And is there any overlap between scientific method in that sense and these questions that you're pointing to that are not strictly speaking scientific?
I think the overlap is the use of rationality. Science, by its nature, depends on a belief in rationality, that it's possible to do experiments and collect evidence and deduce the nature of things by that approach. There are questions that science can't answer because there's no experiment you can do, but you can still use rationality to try to sift through the options to what that question might lead you to. So I guess that's all I'm saying. So in the book, I think I did it appeal to rationality, but in some instances, it went well beyond what I could prove scientifically. The subtitle of The Language of God is a scientist considering evidence for belief, not proof. We don't have proof. We shall not be given proof.
For people who object to the science of evolution and claim to do so on purely scientific grounds, what would you love to show them in the lab? What kind of evidence would you say, if you could just look at this and see?
Well, so much of that comes from the study of genomes. And that includes some of the more recent evidence about our own history as Homo sapiens, now that it's possible to deduce complete genome sequences from skeletal remains that have been in the ground, sometimes for hundreds of thousands of years, you can really map out the relatedness. We know that we who are of European or Asian background have about 3 or 4% of our DNA that's derived from Neanderthals. That is absolutely compelling. I'd like to show somebody the evidence if they are skeptical about that and just line it up and read out the letters and see how that fits. That may be an awkward kind of realization if you're not of the mind that we humans have had a long period of development, but just arrived 6,000 years ago. But the evidence is incredibly compelling. I think that will probably have a better chance of convincing a skeptic than anything we can do with the fossil record, because the fossil record is, by its nature, very spotty. Most organisms leave no trace of their having been here. Fossils are an extremely rare possibility, and so we have to deal with what we have. We filled in a lot of those. People who say, well, there are big gaps in the fossil record in terms of mammals and fish and what was the missing link and all that. Well, look more closely now. A lot of those gaps have been filled, not necessarily filled by every intermediate step, but you can see how those gaps are closing. Mm-hmm. So I just really worry about people who are, particularly young people, brought up believing that you have to fight against evolution in order to defend your Christian faith, because that's going to be a losing battle. And what will they lose? They may lose their Christian faith. And it's so unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Biologos can teach anybody who's skeptical about this the wonderfully harmonious way to find a path forward that brings together this embrace of amazing science that's now possible and amazing stories about who we are and who Jesus was and how God cares for each one of us. That all fits together.
What excites you about the future of scientific work?
Being director of the National Institutes of Health gives me this wonderful opportunity to look over the whole landscape of what's happening in biomedical research and to see things that are starting to emerge even before they are fully formed. And right now, it's such an exhilarating time. Some of it is basic science, just figuring out how life works and putting those pieces together. The ability, for instance, to deduce the precise atomic structures of almost any protein, which used to take forever and which you can now do by something called cryo-EM. It's just breathtaking what we can see. The ability to do biology one cell at a time, I think, is profound. You could argue there's sort of three big scientific insights about life. One is evolution. One is the molecular basis of how it all works, DNA to RNA to protein. And the third one, which people don't even think about it because we all have known about it since we were 6 years old, is that life is made up of cells. The unit of life is the cell. But our ability to ask individual cells, what are you doing, has been pretty limited. And now, just in the last 4 or 5 years, with this single cell biology effort, you can do that. With a piece of human tissue, you can look at thousands of individual cells and say, what is each one of you up to? And we are taking apart our understanding of biology, whether it's about the immune system, which has all kinds of subsets that we didn't know were there, or some tissue like the pancreatic islet that's making insulin. What else is going on there? We used to have to just grind it up and look at an average answer, and now you look one cell at a time. That is profound.
Okay.
And that's very recent come along. The whole ability to do gene editing, which allows you to do experiments that previously would have taken you years, and now with very simple approaches that high school laboratories are starting to engage in, do simple manipulations of DNA in bacteria or in cells. And the potential there for treatment of genetic diseases, that has me so excited. We now know 7,000 genetic diseases where we know the precise DNA misspelling that causes the disease. We have treatments for maybe 500 of those. If we had a strategy that would allow you to use this gene editing CRISPR-Cas approach to go and fix that misspelling in the appropriate tissue efficiently enough, then you've got a scalable answer to find cures for thousands of diseases, not in the next 500 years, but maybe in the next 10 or 20, how could you not be excited about that?
Amazing.
Amazing possibilities there.
Is the flip side of that coin, though, also some nervousness of what might be possible with gene editing?
That's exactly where I was going to go, because I think there is a flip side, and I think it's one particularly where believers who view human beings as being of a special nature because of our relationship with God ought to think carefully about scenarios that some are willing to begin to discuss about reinventing ourselves. Because not only can you edit a bone marrow cell and cure sickle cell disease, you could edit an embryo and create a human being that has a DNA instruction book that's never happened before. And you might do so for benevolent reasons, but pretty soon you might do so because you think you know how to improve the next generation. Who gets to decide what's an improvement? And are we really smart enough to know all the consequences of those kinds of changes? Even from a safety perspective, this doesn't sound to most of us like a thing that we'd want to do. But from a theological perspective, if we are fearfully and wonderfully made, do we want to be fearfully and wonderfully remade in some other kind of image based on what we think we ought to become? I'm deeply concerned about that. I think most people, whether from a religious or a secular perspective, are concerned about launching into that space, but maybe some of us more than others, because it's more than a question about social justice and safety. Those are both important issues. It's also a question about who we are and who God is and what are the consequences of beginning to interfere with that relationship in fundamental ways that change the nature of our very essence.
At the NIH, you have ethical guidelines and norms put in place for these kinds of questions. But here's another area where we might look to other parts of the world that aren't bound by the United States guidelines that are developed. Are there issues internationally with gene editing that we're aware of, or that we ultimately learn from things that are going on that we would say we would never do those kind of experiments? But historically, that kind of work has happened where we have been the beneficiaries of work that we would have deemed unethical. How do we navigate those kinds of waters?
Very thoughtfully. Already, there are countries in which gene editing of human embryos is taking place, particularly China. There has been at least one experiment of human gene editing in the United States, not supported by the National Institutes of Health. We will not support that kind of research at the present time. In all those instances, the editing was done to show you could do so. The embryo was then not implanted. There was no effort there to actually create a baby. But it did show that the mechanics of this would work, which probably will inspire people to think about taking it to the next step. It concerns me that there is no international body that actually has authority, right down to enforcement authority, about setting boundaries on aspects of biotechnology. We can discuss those things. The National Academy of Sciences of the U.S. held a joint meeting with the Chinese National Academy to talk about gene editing, and that was good that everybody was there. The Brits were there too. And they made some recommendations, but if somebody decided to ignore them, it's not clear what consequences would result.
Jim here from the studio in post-production. We recorded this interview just a few weeks before the news broke that a Chinese scientist did ignore these recommendations. He announced that he had created the world's first genetically edited babies, twin girls who were born in November. There's been an outcry from the international scientific community calling for a moratorium on human embryo gene editing, and Francis wrote a letter as director of the NIH supporting that call for a moratorium. We have links to those resources in the show notes.
So this is an uneasy aspect of where we're going, the potential for mischief. And some would say, well, then we should just stop making these advances. But that can't be right either, because then all those people with those genetic diseases I was just talking about would be doomed.
That seems like an ethical problem too.
Yeah, that would be the least ethical choice, is to basically stop doing science that could help people because somebody might misuse it. Science gives you information. It opens up possibilities. The moral aspects kick in by whether you decide to pursue those possibilities or not. Knowledge is not itself good or evil. It's the applications that make it so. Here's where NIH has a particularly important role to play. We are the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world. We are an organization that people tend to look to try to establish some kind of framework of where the boundaries are. We will continue to do that, but I can't argue that that will always carry the day.
So I've heard you also talk about another major area, which is neuroscience, actually mapping out the brain. So
yeah,
tell us some about what are the promise and perils of that area.
Yeah, glad to, because this is another amazing frontier. The idea that you might actually be able to understand the circuits in the human brain and how they do what they do seemed out of reach until fairly recently. You have 86 billion neurons between your ears. Each one of those neurons has about 1,000 connections. The complexity of that system is probably at the top of the list of the most complex structures in the known universe.
Hey, that's the universe. I think you're right, though. It only takes 4 equations to describe a star. So I think a brain is definitely more complex.
And yet the whole thing runs on very little power. It's just amazing when you start to think about the abilities of this biosystem to do what it does. And we'd love to understand that better because things go wrong and we don't know how to treat them without understanding what normal function ought to look like. So we do have now, it's an international effort, but the U.S. has the biggest investment, the Brain Initiative, which aims by 2025 to have a pretty solid grasp on how those circuits in the brain carry out those functions, which means developing and applying technologies that can look at millions of neurons at a time in real time and see what they're doing as you are interpreting some sort of incoming visual material, or you are initiating some voluntary motor movement, or you're laying down a memory or retrieving it. We don't know how that works. We're going to know how that works. The potential there for applications to things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or schizophrenia or autism or depression is going to be enormous. But there will be lots of philosophical and theological questions as well. What is a spiritual experience really all about? If you figure out what circuits fired when you had that spiritual experience, does that make it less significant or more significant?
What's next for Francis Collins?
I don't really know. I'm very poor at making long-range plans. My career would be good evidence for that, since almost nothing that I've done is what I thought I was going to do. How long this goes on, I don't know. As long as I can contribute in this way, then I feel like I should be doing that. But I don't think I'll end up retiring from this job, although maybe I should think about that because I'm 68. I think I've got another chapter out there somewhere. I just don't know when or what or where.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation and more than 300 individuals who donated to our crowdfunding campaign. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerworth, with additional production assistance by Truthworks Media. Original music in this episode was produced by Carp. More music available at the link in our show notes. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We are produced out of the BioLogos offices in Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find the link in the show notes for the BioLogos forum. Find more episodes of Language of God on your favorite podcast app or at our website, biologos.org, where you'll also find tons of great articles and resources on faith and science. Finally, if you're enjoying the show and want to help us out, leave a review on iTunes. We love hearing from you, and it helps other people find the show. Thanks.